Blog Talk Radio.
Law of Attraction Talk Radio. Get ready to be the best you can be. Stay tuned for the Law of Attraction Talk Radio with Jules. Well, welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful, sunny, and refreshing Southern California, and I am so very, very pleased you could join us. We have got a great show for you tonight with Dr. Bernie Siegel. Now, for many, Bernie needs no introduction. He has touched many lives all over the planet. In 1978, he began talking about patient empowerment and the choice to live fully and die in peace. As a physician who's cared for and counseled many, many people whose mortality had been threatened by illness, Bernie embraces a philosophy of the mind-body connection, which has influenced the medical community into understanding the medical ethics and spiritual issues that grapples our society today. It's a great show, so stay tuned right after these words. Hi, this is Julie Johnson here to let you know about my favorite hypnosis session called Health, Wealth, and Well-Being. You know, this is so effective because it allows you to release old thought patterns by a simple weeding out process. Powerful suggestions of wealth and self-esteem are given to fill your subconscious so that you can become the health, wealth, and well-being magnet that is yours by divine right. This instant download is not only more cost-effective than a personal hypnosis session, it works better because you can replay it on a continual basis, rewiring the brain to accept new health and wealth attitudes. So visit lawofattractiontools.com hypnosis page for instant downloads and start creating your new life today. That's www.lawofattractiontools.com. Now, next week, we're going to have Robert Holden coming to us from London to share stories of the Happiness Project that was featured on Oprah and to talk about his book, Happiness Now. You know, life without happiness is hell, so why not choose happiness? This is going to be another worthwhile show that you aren't going to want to miss. So now I want to go ahead and introduce Bernie Siegel, MD, a surgeon living in Connecticut. Bernie wrote his first book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, in 1986, which redirected his life to write 8 more significant books on how we can stop being victims and live life in ways to enhance our physical and emotional well-being. Welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio, Bernie. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, you're welcome.
Now, Bernie, you were the medical pioneer that introduced the mind-body connection to people through your book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I am rereading my book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, written 20 years ago, and I'm amazed in a sense at what's in it. You know, because I've been saying the same thing for 20, 30 years. You know, what I wrote came out of my experience, and that as physicians, we're just not trained in this area at all. And the interesting thing is, when I say as physicians, yeah, I met psychiatrists, psychotherapists who were into this in the sense of how helping people get their lives in order also helped them physically. For instance, the psychiatrist Carl Menninger, when I wrote my book, said to me, he wrote a wonderful comment. And he said he was writing a book, or about to, called 12 Hopeless Cases. And those were people that he saw as a psychiatrist, all of whom were told, you know, they had a hopeless, incurable disease, and they're all perfectly well today. And he said, I don't have to write it, you've written it. And the interesting thing is that what I found, again, when I try to write articles, the medical journals refuse them as inappropriate. They said, it's interesting, but it's inappropriate. When you send them to her as appropriate, they said, it's not interesting. We know this. And again, that was more into the psychotherapeutic areas. And I, in a sense, got angry because it was like, hey, I'm a doctor and nobody's told me all this. I worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who's a psychiatrist. I did some drawings for her, and she told me about my life from the drawings. And, I mean, a simple example is, she said, what are you covering up? I said, what are you talking about? She said, you've made snow on the mountain. I said, yeah, it's a mountain with snow. She said, no, the page is white. You took a white crayon and added another layer. So what are you covering up? And it was like, oh. And yeah, I was hiding all my pain and feelings and a whole host of things. And so I started doing drawings with patients. And it was amazing what you've learned, literally, about their body through symbols. And again, you come across Carl Jung. Again, here's a psychiatrist who, I think it was 70 or 90 years ago, I can't, you know, because I'm just rereading this, he listened to a dream that was presented to him at a conference, and he made a correct diagnosis of a brain tumor simply from this patient's dream. And again, you don't meet a medical student who's ever told, ask patients, what are they dreaming? You know, it may tell you what's going on. And so, again, it really became exciting to me. And I think I caused trouble because I was a physician and a surgeon, meaning that Norman Cousins, you know, did his thing. But, you see, a doctor could say, well, you know, that's a story. It's Norman Cousins. You know, how do we know he even had it, you know? But when Siegel would get up, it was very confrontational. You know, he's got an MD after his name. So I got on all the famous talk shows with everybody arguing with me. Because, again, when you say to a person, you see, studies have now been done, two examples. One is cancer patients who laugh live longer. The other was a study of loneliness. If you're lonely, it affects the genes that control immune function. So you can develop an autoimmune disease where it's overactive and attacks you, or you can develop cancer, but you're more likely to statistically, say, if you're lonely. And I always cite, even the poets knew this, you see, meaning that W.H. Auden wrote about a woman who develops cancer, and the doctor says to his wife, cancer's a funny thing. Childless women get it, men when they retire, as if there had to be an outlet for their foiled creative fire. See, now when you recite that, an oncologist said to me, well, just because it rhymes doesn't mean it's true. But now studies show this. So, you know, and even the effect of a pet after a heart attack, that it dramatically reduces the mortality rate if you go home to a house with a dog after your heart attack versus a house without a dog. And again, all of this is scientific. It's about the chemistry of your body and the connections and relationships.
And when you started, you didn't have the benefit of all of those scientific studies. So I can imagine you had a very confrontational time. But even more important, thank goodness you stuck with it and you had the courage to keep on going because it changed everything for us.
You know, it were things that I saw, and as you said, I didn't know that other people had seen this, written about it, or even studied it because I was just sharing what I saw. And, you know, that's when doctors would again get angry, and I'd say, look, I'm telling you the truth. This is about a patient, I'm telling you. And they would say, I can't accept it. And I'd say, look, I could say that I can't understand it or I can't explain it, but why say you can't accept it? But again, if it isn't a part of your education, you just slam the door on it. You know, I always say quantum physicists and astronomers, they're dealing with uncertainty all the time, you know. They don't say I can't accept that, you know. They study things because they don't have all the answers. But, you know, it's like you become an engineer or a doctor or whatever, you know, or an accountant, and you say, okay, we got all the answers. No, we don't have all the answers. So you have to live with an open mind and live from what you experience. Because when you're controlled by your beliefs, it again, slams the door. See, I can't believe that. I can't accept it. But if you say, look what I've just noticed or experienced or seen, then your mind stays open.
You know, I remember back in 1987, I saw you speak at the Unity Church of the Palm Beaches in Florida. My husband had just been diagnosed with colon cancer a few years earlier, and fighting the cancer was absolutely devastating. But when I heard you speak, it was the first time I realized that we had become victims of cancer, and we absolutely needed to change our attitudes about it. Fortunately for me, I understood your message on a very profound level, but unfortunately for my husband, his fear was so huge about the C word, and he just couldn't grasp such a new concept, and he died. It was very confusing to him to think that he could possibly create such a devastating disease such as cancer. So that leads me to ask, even though I know completely that we do create our illness, how do you respond to people who may not understand that they create their cancer or their ill health?
Yeah, it's the biggest hurdle I saw then was the guilt, shame, and blame. And that's part of why I got a lot of criticism because, I grew up with parents who loved me. I did well in school, and I get along with God. So I'm from a minority group, if you will. And so when I would say to somebody, what's happened last year or two in your life, it wasn't, what did you do wrong? You know, you're to blame for getting your disease. It was, let's see what would have made you vulnerable now. Mm. Again, if it's Christopher Reeve's wife, you know, you'd hear that, oh, my husband is quadriplegic. Oh, that's going to affect you. I've retired. My son was killed in an accident. You know, these are things that we would then look at, work on, how does it affect your life, your emotions. You know, it's all the kids have left home. Who am I now? I'm not mama anymore. So it was helping people, in a sense, rebirth themselves, you know, recreate their lives.
Interesting.
It also was looking at the emotional aspect or experience, that if you live in fear, it's destructive, what it does to your immune function and everything else. Whereas if you're in a growth phase, if you're loving, then it helps you to heal. And so all of these things enter into it. And I would often say to people, how would you describe what you were going through? Meaning that it's not colon cancer, it's, you know, draining, fearful, failure, sucking, all these words that popped out of people. And then I'd say, all right, let's look at how those words fit your life. What else, what's draining you? Say, what's causing pressure? Let's work on those things and help to heal your life. Then the disease, in a sense, became a guide and a teacher, and people would, many of them would say, oh, it's a gift, it's a wake-up call, it's a new beginning, because it's made them look at their mortality, you see, but it's not afraid of dying, it's, I am going to someday, so what do I do with my time, and how do I live, and if you really begin to enjoy it, because there's a poem from John Updike, one line in it says, because think about it. So you have surgery. Your body heals. Hey, how does it know how to do that? Why does it do it? Because it, as John Updike said, your body loves you. But does your body know you love life? That's the message it has to get.
Wow.
So Monday morning, we have more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. Why? Because as far as your body's concerned, you don't want to get up. You know, you don't want to leave home. Well, fine, I'll keep you home, I'll put you in the hospital, I'll get you out of here. So if you get up every day loving life, it also has, again, physical, you know, reactions within your body. And maybe people understand it better if I say it in a very simple way, that when you take an actor and an actress and you put them in a performance and you give them a comedy script, immune function goes up, stress hormone levels go down. Then you take that script away and you give them a tragedy where there's a murder of a loved one and so forth. And you have them act that out. And the opposite happens. Immune function goes down, cortisol levels, stress hormone levels are up. And, you know, what impressed me is they're only acting. I mean, literally, they're on a stage performing and it's affecting their body chemistry. So think about it when it's really a part of your life. You know, how your feelings become your chemistry. And if you are enjoying life, yeah. Because you mentioned Florida. There was a gentleman in Miami. He was very wealthy. developed cancer, was told he had a few months to live. And I was down there speaking. And his son said, "Would you talk to my father at breakfast?" I said, "I'm busy the whole day. I really don't have to." "Oh, please, please." So, okay. So I meet them in the restaurant, and we talk for a while over breakfast. And he goes home. And what was his big decision? He said, "I went back to the office, and I told all the employees, we're canceling the dress code. I got a few months to live. Who cares if you got a tie on? So wear whatever you're comfortable." Then his wife said to him, "You know, you always wanted a house on the ocean, so why don't we get one? Spend your last few months there. You can sit on the deck and listen to Bernie's tapes." Okay, he buys a house on the ocean. And he starts listening. 5.5 years later, he died. Now, he also literally changed his hospital because they realized, see, they didn't say, "Oh, maybe we made a mistake in your diagnosis or you had a nice cancer." They realized this guy made the difference. And so they changed how they treated people with what they've learned from him. And I have to add one anecdote that I noticed is in my book. This is a Quaker friend of mine who was told by a doctor, "You're going to kill your cancer." He had leukemia. And he said, "I don't kill anything. I'm a Quaker. I'm a conscientious objector." And he got up and walked out of the office. And he went home to do lots of vitamins and other things. And he lived for 12 years, by the way. But what was funny is, somewhere along the way, he fell, hit his head, and had a severe concussion. So he was in bed for about a month. And what's he doing in bed? Meditating, listening to tapes, you know, healing himself. And when they went to the doctor a month later, the doctor said, "My goodness, this is the best blood count you've ever had." And his wife said, "Yeah, if we hit him in the head once a month, he'll probably get well." But, you know, those things are not an accident. And as I say, from the laughter to everything else, it changes your chemistry.
You know, in your book, you mentioned that death is not a failure. Wow. To me, that is the most powerful statement that I had not heard before. That hit me right between the eyes.
You know, it what drives me nuts, and I'm always writing letters to the editor, I can't say they're always published, but, you know, when you read about somebody in your town or some famous person, and it says, you know, Joe Smith lost his battle.
Exactly.
And I always write and say, he didn't lose his battle. We're all going to die. Death is not a failure. You're not a loser. And part of the trouble, Mother Teresa taught me something. She said, when invited to an anti-war rally, "I'm not coming." And everybody looks at her. She said, "Oh, but if you have a peace rally, call me."
Mm.
See? And that's what happens when we wage a war, and I've written an article about this on my website. When you wage a war against cancer, you empower your enemy. But when you're saying, "How can I find peace? How can I heal my life?" that's a very different perspective. See, then death is not the failure. I'd say not living is the failure. But to me, teaching people how to live, the byproduct is a longer, healthier life. But it's not, the focus is not avoiding death. This is a line from Woody Allen. Maybe people will understand. One guy's very depressed and talking about the bleak horrors of life, and his friend listens to him and then says, "What are you doing Saturday night?" And the guy says, "I'm committing suicide." And his friend says, "How about Friday night?" And to me, that's what we have to think about in our life. It may be your life's going to end on Saturday, but what the hell are you doing Friday? You know? I mean, why waste your lifetime? And then I always say, if you have a good time Friday, you may say to your friend, "I'm changing my plans." Let's see, I'll see about it on Sunday, you know? Because, again, when I use the term born again or rebirthing, that's what I've seen people do. They, you know, whether it's taking your tie off, moving to Colorado, changing jobs, playing your violin. I mean, I don't make up these stories, all these crazy things people have done. And then they notice, hey, I'm not dying. I mean, the man who went to Colorado because he loved it and wanted to die there in the mountains, I called a year later because I was furious that the family hadn't invited me to his funeral because he did not have very much longer to live. And he answered the phone. And his quote was, "It's so beautiful here, I forgot to die." So, but I can say, and, you know, when I told that story in Colorado, people say, "We don't understand why it helped him." I said, "I think some of you need to be in Florida." You know? So it isn't where you're living. It's, you know, it's where you are living, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Are you alive in that place and want to be there, and that job and that family and all the things that you're doing?
I had read somewhere that you had wished to be a few inches taller, and you achieved this. How did you do it?
Well, I said my work has been a growth process. So I'm taller now. Because Woody Allen said if he had one wish, it would be to be somebody else. And I said, I'd just like to be a few inches taller. And, you know, but this has been an enormous growth process. Because I've seen how I handle things now. And by that, I mean adversity. You know, our family isn't invulnerable. My wife was diagnosed with breast cancer last December. But I noticed how I handled that. You know, one day at a time, enjoying our life, versus many, many years ago when I thought one of our children had cancer. That's because of an x-ray showed he had a tumor that was eating away at a bone. Turned out to be a rare benign tumor. But when I saw that x-ray, my first thought as a doctor was, he'll be dead next year. And he said to me, now picture this, a seven-year-old comes to his father, says, can I talk to you for a minute? I said, yes, what is it? He said, you're handling this poorly. That's 7 years old. Because he said to me, we're trying to have fun and go out and play, and you want us in our bedroom depressed. You know, we have five children, so I was trying to explain to all of them, your brother's going to be dead. And all he wanted to do was have a nice day, and his father wants him, you know, sad in his room. And so I've learned a lot in 30 years about living, about not giving away my power, you might say, knowing that I can control my thoughts and my feelings, and I work on it every day, because, life is difficult. See, not unfair, because when you say to people, is life fair, everybody screams no. I say, it must be, you're all complaining. Life is difficult, and that's what I've learned, how to deal with the difficulties. Most of us don't learn it from our parents, literally. They don't teach us what I call survival behavior and give us mottos to live by. You know, what we hear is, you're a failure, you embarrassed us, you've never done well, you need to study more. It just goes on and on. And the kids who grow up feeling unloved, they, by midlife, almost 100% of them have suffered a major illness. And it's again, you see, what I've said to people is information is not the key. You know, I was reading in the paper today, some guy weighs 700 pounds. He's not stupid. He knows it's not good for him. Why is he doing it? And I say, almost certainly, he was never loved, and so food became his way of loving himself. And others will choose other addictions, alcohol, drugs, whatever. And even the kids that you read about who are there, go to school, shoot everybody, and then commit suicide. That's about rejection. And a reaction to that rejection, and the rage, and the anger, and then the guilt, and they commit suicide. And, you know, I've written a book on parenting, too. And it's because I see the role that parenting plays. I mean, I'm working with cancer patients who are saying, I can handle the cancer, but my mother's words are still eating away at me. I mean, you're talking to a 50-year-old person, and the mother's words are still eating away at them.
And you still have your ECAP meetings, right?
Yes, we still have support group meetings, right.
And you use the word carefrontation in it.
Yeah, because we care about people, but I confront them. You know, I don't run a victim group. Because some people will come to my group and say, oh, I went to another group where I felt worse when I went home because everybody's complaining about how terrible their life is and their family is. And no, that, if somebody comes in and says, I got the worst husband in the world, I'll say, I have a mafia friend. Where does your husband work? We'll eliminate him. You know, they look at you. I say, look, you've got power. You know, you have choices. You can choose to get a divorce, to leave. In other words, you can eliminate your husband in many ways. Or you can say, let's see what love will do to this relationship. But I confront people in the sense of saying, you got a choice. I think some of it's my personality, you know, like the surgeon, you cut through everything. So, yeah, a lot of people have said to me that they began to get better when I told them I was sick and tired of hearing them complain about their parents and their husband and their, you know, and their kids. And they suddenly looked up, and one woman said to me, that's when I started getting better. Because I just couldn't stand listening to her keep complaining about her parents. I mean, I have to say, her parents committed suicide, asked their children to kill themselves. I mean, this was a horrendous situation. But still, you know, enough already. And then at that moment, she changed her life, and this is somebody who should have been dead years ago, and 30 years later, still walking around.
Well, where do beliefs come into all of this? Every day you hear reports of something in our environment causing problems or causing cancer, such as now plastic water bottles leaching chemicals. Is it our beliefs in that we believe what people are telling us about the environment really the cause of the problem, or is it the environment?
Let's put it this way, that the genes don't make decisions. So there are many things that affect the genes and lead to disease. Now, that can be, let's say we have twin sisters, all right?
Uh-huh.
One is a sweet kid who makes mommy and daddy happy and internalizes anger. The other one's a devil. Who's more likely to get cancer? The good girl, see? She's not living her life. She's trying to please everybody else. Now, you could also say, what if one sister exercises, eats healthy food, and the other one's into, you know, drugs and smoking and everything? Who's more likely to get sick? So it's your environment, too. I mean, all these things enter into the messages that your body gets. And when you care about yourself, you, in a sense, incorporate all these things. You don't do them to not die. You know what I mean? I always say the bitterest people in heaven are the vegetarian meditating joggers, you know, who wish they slept late and had some other things to eat besides only vegetables. So it isn't that they're doing it to not die. If you love yourself and life, you're doing things because they enhance the quality of your life. I don't deprive myself. You know, it's like saying I'm never going to have ice cream or something. You know what I mean? I don't deprive myself. I enjoy life, but I would say, okay, but I'm not going to have a quart of ice cream every night. You know, I think about what's good for you, what's not good for you, what do you want to enjoy.
I'm glad to hear that ECAP is still ongoing. Has it changed or expanded its approach since the 1980s?
Well, there's a center. It used to be with me in New Haven, Connecticut, but now it's run by Dr. Barry Bittman and his wife, Karen, out in Meadville, Pennsylvania. So that's where the center is. And they do training, retreats, you know, workshops there. And, yes, and I go around lecture, and ECAP has a website, too. So, you know, I dialogue with people, share with people all the time. So, in a sense, I'm running support groups all around the world through the Internet. And, again, I don't know if I mentioned it, my website, because it's easier to remember this, Bernie Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, MD.com. If you go there, you'll see an ECAP symbol, which stands for Exceptional Cancer Patients. If you click on that, it'll jump you right over, and you'll see my schedule, our discussion groups, and things like that. And all the books and, you know, and audio things I've done are available there.
Yes, and you have written 8 really, really tremendous books. You know, you said something once that when you keep on rereading books, you learn something new every time.
Yeah, I think that what I found, this was sort of accidental one day, as I'm driving to various lectures and things, I take some, you know, audio stuff with me, and I had listened to everything, so I popped something else in that I'd listened to before. And as I'm listening, I thought, this is better than it was before. And I even wrote to this friend of mine saying, your lecture has improved a lot in the last 2 years. But what I realized was I was hearing things that I hadn't been aware of before. And I noticed the same thing in books. I tend to, if I see something meaningful, I mark, you know, the sentences, and then I fold the corner of the page down. So if I'm ever glancing through the book again, you know, I can look at those areas and see what I thought was worthwhile and important. And as I have reread some of these books, page by page, I notice that I'm folding more corners down and marking more things. And it's like, well, why didn't you notice it last time? Because I wasn't developed enough to notice it. And I always tell this to people. Listen to audio tapes, reread books, and if they don't get any better, I'd say you're not getting any better. And that's why I enjoyed my own book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, because I could see all the themes that I'm dealing with now are in it. You know, I have elaborated on them and learned how important many things are, but there's all the wisdom, you know, already there.
Well, Love, Medicine, and Miracles was truly my favorite book. As a matter of fact, I bought so many copies and I gave them out to so many friends.
Yeah, what I've learned is, again, that you can't change people. So when somebody gets up in the audience and says, oh, you saved my life, your book saved my life, I say, whoop, let me correct that. I can't and the book can't, only you can. All we can do is coach you. So that's what I've learned and why I say to family members, you don't want to help them? Fine, give them a book. But if the book goes in the wastebasket or sits unread on the, you know, shelf, don't yell at them. That's their choice. They have to be ready for it. People call me and say, will you call my, you know, husband, cousin, and see if you can? I say, no. Here's my phone number. Give it to them. If they call me, happy to talk, or call them back if I miss the call. But I don't intrude into somebody's life. I want to know that they have the inspiration and the desire. I always say, if somebody's coming out for the team and I'm the coach, I want to know you're ready to practice and put in the time. And the ones who connect with me, I know are.
You have another great quote. Eliminate what is killing you.
Right.
That is so powerful. And it's really the essence of Love, Medicine, and Miracles, isn't it?
Yeah. It, you know, that, and again, these are, people have to realize, neither I nor anybody else has anything new to say. It's understanding what has been written. And the line that gets me was, he who seeks to save his life will lose it. See, what does that mean? If you become, see, like the good girl, you become what everybody else wants, then you lose your life. You're making everybody else happy, but not yourself. And then the next sentence, he who's willing to lose his life will save it. But what kids don't understand is, you don't kill yourself. That's not what that sentence is saying. You, again, eliminate what's killing you, see. So you lose the untrue self. That's what you eliminate and destroy. And you save your true life. And as my mother used to put it, do what will make you happy. Whenever you had a decision, you know, you'd come to her and say, hey, Ma, I got a problem. I don't know what to do. Do what will make you happy. I mean, and it was like, what? Wait a minute. You know, because, and I mean this, you know, my father lost his job and called my mother to say he had a secure offer and a risky offer. What should he do? And she said, do what will make you happy. You know, not, oh, well, we need money or we need security or go take a chance. It's, you know, she would force people to pay attention to their feelings. And as a lawyer said, I came to a conclusion that was eminently reasonable, totally logical, and completely wrong, because while learning to think, I almost forgot how to feel. And that's what my mother forced us to do, feel, and listen to your heart. So if you did that, you didn't do the wrong thing, you know? Like my father could have lost the job, but he still did what felt right for him, and then you see what comes.
You had made a prediction that in the next decade, the role of consciousness, spirituality, non-local healing, and heart energy would be explored as scientific subjects. Well, you're right on target.
It's 30 years later than it should be, but to me, what I'm fascinated by is just consciousness. You know, we take organs from one person, put them in another, and guess what happens? When the recipient wakes up, they know about the donor's life.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with heart-lung transplants. People wake up, and there's one woman that I helped at Yale, Claire Sylvia, she wrote a book, A Change of Heart, because when she woke up after a heart-lung transplant and said, I want a beer, I mean, she thought, where's that coming from? I don't like beer. And then she got on a motorcycle, and to make a long story short, she had the heart and lungs of a young man who loved beer, chicken McNuggets, and died in a motorcycle accident. And she, in a dream, actually, he came up to her and told her his name. And she searched the obituaries and found the name and contacted the family, and they said, you're absolutely right. You have his heart and lungs, and there are many other stories.
My goodness.
I mean, another example. I have a friend who's a animal intuitive. She talks to animals. I thought that was nuts, you know? Just as doctors would say to me, I can't accept that, my thought was, come on, how do you talk to animals? And but when one of our pets disappeared, I called her. She's in Los Angeles. I'm in Connecticut. And I said to her, okay, where's this cat? And after several days, she sent me an email saying, because she asked for a picture, which I never even sent her. Because, if I, you know, with clients, she asked for a picture, and then she tries to focus on the animal. And she called, emailed me and said, the cat's alive. I can see the moon through its eyes. And then she described in detail the house and the other pets and everything else. And I picked up the cat the next morning. And again, my disbelief was changed, and it became a foreword in her book, which is called, oh yeah, Straight from the Horse's Mouth. Her name is Amelia Kincaid. But again, the you know, the government, the CIA uses distant viewing. You'd say, how do people do these things? Well, our consciousness isn't local. And I think many of the things that we call past lives literally are our being aware of what has preceded us. It's like the consciousness of those who have lived before us are part of our awareness, so they affect our lives too. And I think these are all things that we need to look at, explore. I mean, it's just the fascination of life and of creation. So yes, I can communicate with our animals now, because she's taught me how. And again, it's not, it's the thing that, just again, I think would be most easiest for people to understand. If one of my pets, like I accidentally left the car door open, I mean, I must have hit the car keys and the door, you know, slid open after I walked away from the car. When I came back, I was frantic. You know, the car's open. Where's it? Well, the dog I thought would run away was sitting in the car waiting for me, and the one that I thought would be sitting there is gone. Mm-hmm. And as Amelia said to me, calm down. Because, see, I immediately get frantic, start screaming the dog's name. Well, where could he be? He may run in the woods. And Amelia's comment to me, Bernie, calm down. Get in the dog's head. And so I take a breath, and I get in the dog's head, and I realize, dope, he's looking for you. So I went around to the store I was shopping at, and there's the security guard with my dog, saying, is this yours? I said, yes, it is. And he'd been taking good care of him because he had a dog. But I literally, I thought, I'm going to walk into the market, and there's going to be somebody saying, whose dog is this? Whose dog is it? And that's where he was, at the door. And he has run into restaurants, too, looking for me. But again, it's, you see, you have to get in your animal's head, and then it happens. And I say to any pet owner who's listening, because I get such a kick out of this, every weekend I groom all our pets. We have a lot of cats and dogs. And as soon as I think I'm going to groom, everybody disappears. You know, and I haven't even started doing anything. I'm just thinking it, and they disappear. And then if I say, ah, what the hell, I can't find him, I won't do it, then they all reappear, and I have to step over them, you know, to get to the bedroom or something. And I mean, that has convinced me that it's absolutely amazing. And the animals, I mean, we know that they know our chemistry, too, because we use dogs to predict heart attacks, strokes, seizures,
uh-huh.
You know, as well as skin cancers. They can detect that change in the chemistry and the aroma, if you will. And I think that, again, our consciousness affects the people around us. So that when, and again, studies have been done showing how healing touch, you know, when somebody comes in who loves you, cares about you, and does a healing touch, it's a change in energy. And it has shown, whether you're working with plants, you know, you work on water, then water a plant with this water that's been worked on by a healer, and the plant grows faster than plain water. But a recent study, somebody sent me an article out of the paper, showed that you change cellular growth. These are studies done with animals and others where they used healers, and it affected the growth of the animal, you know, versus people who just stood there holding their hands over the animal. And so doctors have to understand this too, that our consciousness, if we're tired, worn out, depressed, sure a patient's going to die, when we walk into the room, we are affecting the patient. And I've learned that from the patients, because they have said, you know, you walk in and somebody says, what's the matter? I say, why are you asking? Well, you know, look at you. And I say, well, I'm thinking about how to help you. And this woman said to me, think in the hallway and smile when you come in here. And so it was obvious that my attitude was affecting them, and my anger. Yeah, I've had patients tell me that they were getting gifts for all their doctors, but not me. And I said, why not? Because you're always angry. I said, I didn't like what's wrong with you. I don't like what we had to do to you. And he said, you took it out on me, though. You see, in doctors, it never occurred to me that my anger at his disease, he was feeling as personal and affecting our relationship.
In that sense, I think that you are the one who has changed the medical profession on how to interact with the patient. I think I really attribute all of that to you.
Well, I've helped. I mean, there are some who pay no attention to me, and there are a lot who do. And a lot of medical students are calling. That's my greatest gift, when they call up and say, will you come to our school and talk to us? Mm. Yeah, because I want to talk to you about why are you a doctor. See, that's a whole other issue. If you become a doctor for unhealthy reasons, you know, it's like saying you become a psychiatrist because you're troubled, then you're going to treat your troubles, not your patients. And Carl Menninger also, he had a sense of humor because he said, what if you become a surgeon because of destructive tendencies? So as a, you know, as a reaction formation to your destructive tendencies, you become a surgeon. So now I can cut people up and I don't end up in jail. See? Again, if we were in medical school and they said, well, this is from a dean. He said, most of the students are writing down, I'm fascinated by the human body. Well, then the dean needs to sit down and say, do you know that people are coming in the body and you're going to have to be ready to treat people? Because I always remember a veterinarian saying to me when I said, I can't take the pain of being a surgeon, I'm going to become a veterinarian. And he said, don't, because people bring the pets in. See? Because I was talking about the pain of caring for people. And he really helped me also by saying, look out in your waiting room. There's people. Stop seeing disease. See people. That's when I began to make that shift. So I started saying to people, not what's wrong. See, when you take a medical history, what's called the present illness, it starts with chief complaint. Think about that. So you go to a doctor and the doctor says, okay, what's your chief complaint? What's wrong? Now, what if the doctor said, hello, how may I help you? See? That would leave you open, I think, to discuss things in a different way. Because when it's chief complaint, it could be, you know, I have an ulcer or my stomach hurts. What does that tell you about what's going on in your life? And now, the present illness is about when did it start, how long have you had the symptoms. You see, again, it's more about time and things you're feeling. And even your family history is, what did your mother die of, what did your father die of, what are you allergic to, you know, that kind of thing. But never do they stop and say, what's going on in your life? How can I help you? And when you ask those kinds of questions, yeah, then things change. And again, studies have shown that when the doctor listens, in other words, when people came out of a doctor's office, they were asked, did the doctor listen to you? And those who said yes were more likely to respond to treatment than those who said no. And look at our system today, especially with managed care and insurance companies. And you become a psychiatrist and they tell you, well, have 15-minute visits every month and refill the prescription. I care about people. What if I want to talk to people? Oh, no, no, no. We don't have time for that. And that's why the students need to know, did you become a doctor for healthy reasons or unhealthy reasons? And I think Kevorkian is a prime example of somebody who, from the time he was a medical student, was fascinated with death. He goes into pathology. He never practiced medicine. He was a pathologist. And then here he is helping people to die. I help people live, and then it makes it easier when they get tired and want to die. So I've helped people die too. But I don't need to help them commit suicide. I help them straighten out their lives, tell their families, and then turn off the switch. So I've watched my in-laws, my parents, have no trouble dying when they were ready and the family isn't arguing with them. You see, because then death isn't a failure, loss. It's, hey, this is my time to leave my body. You know, when you don't enjoy your body anymore, then, as I say, the next therapy is get out of it. When you see this in drawings, it's always a purple kite, balloon, butterfly. It's a very spiritual transition. You know, that it's it's time for me to live and to leave and become perfect again. Because that I'll guarantee people. See, that's another fascinating aspect of consciousness. You're blind from the time of birth. You're in a severe auto accident. You leave your body, and you can see for the first time ever. And then they resuscitate you, and you're back in your body, and you're blind again. And a gentleman named Ken Ring wrote a book called Mind Sight, which gives examples of people who are blind and have near-death experience. When I was 4 years old, I almost choked to death on a toy. I had a whole bunch of pieces of a toy in my mouth. You know, I was acting like a carpenter, taking things apart, and a plumber. And I had seen these guys in my house working and putting screws and nails in their mouth and then taking them out again. So I put everything in my mouth and I aspirated it, and I was choking to death. And I couldn't call for help. I was alone in my bedroom. I left my body. And literally, as a four-year-old, I remember this, that I didn't want to go back. I thought, wow, this is neat. But you see, it didn't occur to me, how can you see? You're not in your body anymore, because I'm used to seeing. And when I didn't die, I yelled out, who did that? Meaning that, you know, who made the decision I shouldn't die? Who didn't agree with me? Because I was really angry to not die. But it's an experience that's always been with me, so I'm not afraid to leave my body. Yes, will there be grief? Sure. There's a lot of loved ones, you know. I would like to stay with them. But it's the love that's the thing, the permanence. And that's why my recent book is written in the style of a children's story, but it's for all ages, for those who lose loved ones, called Buddy's Candle. I mean, it's how do we live the life that our loved ones would want us to live? So whether your dog dies or your cat or your, you know, spouse, what would they want from you? And it isn't that they want you to sit around crying all day long. They want you to enjoy the day. As our son said years ago, you're handling this poorly. So it doesn't mean that I don't cry when a loved one dies, but it helps me focus on life. In fact, I think everybody, I call them sanctuaries in the house. I have a portrait I painted of my parents hanging in our hallway. So I have to go past it many times a day. And they're my therapists. You know, if I'm having a tough day, they're there looking at me saying, hey, kid, lighten up.
So you believe in an afterlife then?
Well, I believe that consciousness does not die. That's why I think the words make it confusing. I believe that our bodies die, but that our consciousness does not. It's almost like what we know and are aware of, that it remains. And I think those who come after us will be aware of our consciousness. And I think that's why it's important for all of us to be what I call postgraduate students. You know, that if you become an intelligent, caring human being, then you'll make a better world than if you're an angry, bitter, resentful person who wants to get even, you know, next time.
So what I'm hearing you say is if we become a more loving, compassionate person, then the world will evolve into a much more compassionate planet.
I'm working on a novel, which I don't know if will ever be published, but let me give you an example. See, I have a mafia friend named Carmine. Now, in a past life, Carmine's family was killed. Okay? And so his sense is, I'll come back and I'm going to have a family that everybody's going to be afraid of, so he can be at the head of the mafia. But if Carmine were truly enlightened, maybe he'd come back and say, you know what, I'm going to be the head of the United Nations. So I'll create one family, and then there'll be no wars. Mm-hmm. You see, so I'd say there are different levels of enlightenment and the choices that you then make.
Wow, you have some of the best stories and the best quotes I have ever heard. I've listened to your radio show, and it's just some of the things you say is just incredible. I love it.
Well, I'll share with your audience, too, because sometimes I think everybody will be sure I'm crazy by the time the program's over. But I was on the phone one day, just as I am with you, and this friend of mine was saying, hey, what are you doing? And I told her how busy I was, you know, traveling, lecturing. And she said, why are you living this life? Now, her intention was to get me to slow down. But she said, why are you living this life? And I went into a trance. And I said to her, oh, my God. Remember, this is a phone call. I'm not sitting with a therapist. I said, wow. I said, I saw myself with a sword in my hand killing people. I said, maybe that's why I'm a surgeon, to help them with the knife. And I'm not going to go into further details, but I went into a trance and relived an experience that was absolutely incredible about how destructive I was in a past life because I didn't have faith and I didn't understand. You know, what I mean by that is when God says to Abraham, I want you to sacrifice your son, Abraham didn't argue. And you'd say, how come he doesn't argue? Why doesn't he say, take me, not my kid? Why do you want my kid? Can I get something else for you? And it's about faith. So I did a lot of damage with the sword because I didn't have faith. In other words, when my Lord would say to me, go kill, go do this, go do that, I was afraid if I didn't do it, I'd get hurt. But I ultimately learned if I had said, okay, sure, I'll go, like Abraham did, then you end up saying, no, I know you have faith in me. I just was testing you. You don't have to do that. And so I learned the importance of having faith in the right Lord. And the right Lord isn't, you know, material things. It's about making this a better world.
Interesting. We're getting close to the end of the hour, so let me ask real fast. When a person comes in to your ECAP group and they have a terminal illness, what are some of the steps that you take or you give them so that they can become an exceptional patient?
Well, I'd say it's several things. And again, on my website, I have a list that's of an immune-competent personality. So some of it are aspects of your personality, that there's meaning in your life, that you can ask for help, that you can express appropriate anger if you're not treated with respect, you say no if you don't want to do things. You find things that you enjoy. You don't let others prescribe for you. You make the decision. You don't live a role. You live an authentic life. And you use your feelings. So you don't get depressed about being depressed. You say, well, if you're hungry, you get something to eat. So when you don't like how you feel, how do you nourish your life? And I try to guide people through all those things, as well as saying, how would you describe your experience and listening to their words and trying to help them heal their life and their relationship? And a lot of the people who come to the group really come and they'll say, I come because of the people here. I just feel so good being with you. There's more life in that room. So again, it isn't about, you know, I'm trying not to die. It's about I'm trying to live and enjoy my life. And that room is filled with that kind of life and joy. And I've been doing it for 30 years. I've been in therapy for 30 years. And I can tell you, I feel better every time I walk out of that room. And do our members die? Sure they do. But you see, if they've lived, the next session is not a problem. Do you feel badly when somebody hasn't started living and died? You know, then you just feel like a weight and a burden. And you just wish you could have done something for them. And, you know, I always love what you just said a minute ago. Because whenever you're doing a program, you know, people will say, we're running out of time. and that's my message to everybody. We're all going to run out of time. So enjoy your time. And then I think you'll find, as I said, you'll get a little extra time, too, because of how it feels. One of our sons put it very nicely, because I say to all your listeners, you have 15 minutes to live, what would you do? And I heard some answers that I didn't particularly like. And our son said, he'd buy a quart of chocolate ice cream and eat it. And I said, okay, you're enlightened. I'm not sure about the other people. And somebody said to me, but what if that's their chocolate ice cream? And I said, oh, thank you. I didn't understand. Because, you see, what may be my chocolate ice cream isn't yours, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I just say to everybody listening, ask yourself, what's your chocolate ice cream? And go do it. Because when you lose track of time, I think you're in the healthiest state you can ever be in. You really enter a trance state, and your body is getting wonderful live messages because you're enjoying every moment and not even aware of the time going by.
Oh, my goodness, Bernie. Thank you so much. This was so fantastic. You are such a tremendous blessing to this world. I can't thank you enough.
Let me tell you, that's the next important point. What you see in others is what's within you. And when you tell me I'm a blessing, guess what? You're a blessing, or you wouldn't see it in me.
Oh.
And I'd say if everybody else in your life is, you know, a terrible, awful person, you better ask yourself what's going on inside of me. And I find that if I accept criticism, it's a positive sign. People know I care, give me feedback, criticism, coaching, whatever you want to call it, to try to make me a better person. And if I'm always making excuses, they stop talking to me and telling me what I'm doing wrong because they know I don't care or I blame them.
Wonderful. Great lesson for us all. Let me just remind everybody that they can go to Bernie Siegel, that's SIEGELMD.com, to find out more about his programs, about the group therapy, about the books, articles, anything. It's really a great site, and I encourage all of you to go, and especially get the book of Love, Medicine, and Miracles. It changed my life, and I know it will change yours. And again, thank you, Bernie. I truly appreciate you taking the time and coming out and talking to us on Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Thank you.
And to all of our wonderful listeners, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and I look forward to talking with you again next week. You have been listening to the Law of Attraction Talk Radio, hosted by Jules Johnson. For more information, go to www.lawofattractiontools.com.